Les conférences du Collège de France.
Merci beaucoup d'être venu. Et aujourd'hui, nous allons avoir la suite de la conférence de mardi dernier sur le livre des chroniques en Afrique du Sud avant et après Apartheid avec le professeur Jonker qui nous vient de l'université de Stellenbosch en Afrique du Sud.
Thank you, Matteo, and thank you for all of you being here. And also for those people online, I know that the video recording is actually the main thing afterwards, also that it is still available. So all of you who are tuning in on the video recording, you are most welcome, and I hope that you will find it also a sensible talk. Now, before I start, last week when I spoke here, I mentioned that Professor Thomas Roemer is not here because he's in South Africa. I'm from South Africa and I'm here. But he was in Pretoria last week to receive an honorary doctorate. And what I want to show you is how he looks like when he receives his doctorate. That's the tradition back home also with all the regalia going with it. So you will probably recognize the face, but for the rest, I assume that's not how he normally lectures here in this room. But in any case, again, to Thomas, also congratulations. And it is actually, I heard from the colleagues from Pretoria, that was a joyous occasion. So I'm very glad for him. Now, I just want to link to what we did last week. Last week, the previous lecture was a reflection on the influence of socio-political transformation in the South African context on Bible interpretation, as well as on the hermeneutical shifts that were brought about in post-apartheid South Africa. You would remember that I asked a question last week also of, may we change biblical interpretation or can we change biblical interpretation? And we spoke about the South African context, the post-apartheid context in particular, that prompted also certain changes. We discussed the apartheid theology and how it was legitimated also from the Bible, and particularly Genesis 11. And then after the changeover in the 1990s, how that impacted also on biblical interpretation in South Africa. Now, you might sit here with a question, how does that relate to an interest in the Hebrew Bible, Book of Chronicles? Many people ask me that question, how do you get from post-apartheid South Africa to Chronicles? Now, Chronicles, as you might know, is a sort of a second historiography that we have in the Hebrew Bible. I will later on say something about its sources. But Chronicles, and that's sort of a summary of my talk today, Chronicles was actually the result of socio-political change and the reinterpretation of older traditions. So that is the link, I would say, also between the hermeneutical stuff that we discussed last week and what we are going to focus on this week, and particularly then the Book of Chronicles. Now, Chronicles is not only a book with socio-political and socio-religious thrust. It is also a hermeneutical guide. And that is quite important. I find this also quite a sort of a unique element of my own work, is to emphasize the hermeneutical significance of the Book of Chronicles, that it's in a certain sense assisting us also with our own interpretations of older traditions, because the origin of this book was actually the result of reinterpretations within the Bible. It's not only after the Bible was completed that people started interpreting it. We have interpretation and reinterpretation already within the Bible. Now, let me give you just a glimpse of the background issues, the introductory issues relating to the Book of Chronicles. Normally, scholars date this book somewhere towards the end of the so-called Achaemenid Persian period and the beginning of the Hellenistic period. If you want to date it then more accurately, one could say the second half of the 4th century BCE, that means from 350 onwards, and the beginning of the 3rd century BCE, that means running sort of into 270, 260 BCE. So it's the transition period between the Persian Achaemenid period and then the Hellenistic period, when the Greek culture also started having an influence. So scholars are more or less in agreement about this issue. We cannot really pinpoint it, because I will explain later on also why the transition is not so much reflected in the Book of Chronicles. In short, the Jerusalem from where these people wrote the book was not so much affected by the so-called Hellenization that was introduced by Alexander the Great. It was more on the lowlands, of course, along the coastal plain, where that changeover had an influence, and the influence came much later to Jerusalem. So it's therefore, I think, quite safe to say that it's going into the Hellenistic period, although the Hellenistic influence is still not so prominent in the book. In terms of authorship, again, we can't pinpoint one specific author or even one group. The best that we can say is that these people were literate. Literati in the post-exilic Jerusalem, consisting mainly of people who returned from exile, from the Babylonian exile, and they were based at the Second Temple. Now, the Second Temple is the rebuilt temple of the first temple period, and some people would say this is the actual temple of the Hebrew Bible. That's the one where the priesthood and the cult and so on was really formalized. So that's the best that we can say. It was Jerusalem was not a big place, not so many people around there, but we know that it was literate people. That was initially when the people were taken into exile, it was mainly the leadership, the political and the religious leadership that were taken into exile. And those were mostly then the people also coming back and resettling in Jerusalem. Of course, there were other peoples also who never went away, and some others that started settling also there. There were quite a lot of tensions in Jerusalem, in the cultic sphere particularly, but not that it points towards a huge city. The sources that the chronicler, and when I use the term chronicler in the single and in the male form, I'm actually referring to this group of literati or writers in the Second Temple period. It's definitely, I would say, not a single person behind it. And secondly, it is definitely a male person behind it, because we know from scribal practice and so on, from the time of the late Achaemenid period and so on, that writing was sort of a privilege of male students who could learn it, while females mostly didn't have that skill, of course, because of the discrimination also against women. So when I use the term chronicler, I'm referring to the authorship. The chronicler made use mainly of the so-called Deuteronomistic history, that is a block of literature in the Hebrew Bible running from Joshua to Kings, but it's mostly the books of Samuel and Kings that were actually used by the chronicler. That's sort of the basis of the story that the chronicler is using. But he is also using materials from the so-called priestly materials of the Pentateuch, of the first five books of the Hebrew Bible or the Torah. And it is also using some post-priestly traditions, particularly from the holiness tradition, the holiness legislation, which was also available at this stage when the chronicler wrote his book. So you can see it's a diversity of materials, but existing traditions that were older or younger, but all of that most probably then also available in written form when the chronicler wrote his book. Now, the next point that I would like to touch on is to sketch you, for you a little bit more in detail the historical context of origin of Chronicles. When we say the late Achaemenid period and early Hellenistic period, what are we actually referring to? Now, just to take it a little bit back earlier, we know that in 539 BCE, King Cyrus II, or Cyrus the Great as we know him, was actually amalgamating different areas into the so-called Persian Empire. Cyrus then took over Babylon in 539 BCE, and thereby also then became the sort of the emperor of all the areas that were formerly under the jurisdiction of the Babylonian Empire, but adding also the areas which was under the Persian jurisdiction. I will show you a map in a while. One very interesting and important document that we have available is namely the so-called Cyrus Cylinder. You see a picture of it there. It is unfortunately not in the Louvre, but in the British Museum this time. But this Cyrus Cylinder is actually then describing in Akkadian language so that the Babylonians could understand it, Cyrus is making the claim and said that Marduk, the god of the Babylonians, actually commissioned him to take Babylon because the king of the Babylonians is actually a weak king and Cyrus should take over. So that's a sort of a legitimation of the rule of Cyrus. But then furthermore, it is also indicating a change in direction in terms of political and especially military strategy. Whereas the Assyrians and the Babylonians mostly made use of military strategies to conquer areas and then take the leadership away into exile, Cyrus then announced in this document that his policy will be different, that he's going to release the exiles to go back to the areas from where they come from, that he's going to allow different peoples also to have their own religions, and he will even support the rebuilding of their temples and so on, as long as they remain loyal to the Persian Empire. So it's often one would say it's a carrot and the stick approach. The carrot was that if you are loyal to us and you pay your taxes regularly and so on, then we will bless you also with safety and with protection. But if you don't do so, if you step out of line, then of course you should expect the stick. Then you are going to be punished by them. So it's not that the Persians were not military people. They were indeed also very active in terms of military campaigns. But the strategy of keeping the empire together was totally different from what the Assyrians and the Babylonians had. The one thing that we should also distinguish is the early Persian period and the late Persian period. Now, the late Persian period, one could say, is more or less then from the end of the 5th century, that means from around 400 BCE. And we know that at that stage, Egypt, which was also under the jurisdiction of the Persian Empire, managed through rebellion to break away from the empire, and then in the end also to become their own kingdom again. That means that for the Persian Empire, suddenly their southern border was no longer in Egypt, but the southern border of the Persian Empire was this very remote little province called Yehud or Judah, as well as Idumea. Idumea was actually formerly the Edomite area. So suddenly they became more important for the empire, and we know that also from archaeological excavations, that the whole line of fortresses were built and so on for the protection of the southern border of the Persian Empire. And of course that was also quite important then, that the areas, the provinces nearest to this border had the task of supplying also for the soldiers who were based there and so on. So that was sort of a changed political context. At that stage, Yehud also became sort of independent, not independent from the Persian Empire, but an own province, in distinction from Samaria, for example. Samaria was actually the one administering Yehud earlier. But from the second part of the Persian Empire, what happened actually is namely that this province had a sort of an own jurisdiction. They started minting coins. They had their own stamp impressions, Yehud stamp impressions and so on, which indicates that there was a much more stronger identity that was taking formation there. I will come back to the issue of identity. The religious context, as we've seen, was namely in the Persian period then a context of diversity. We know of all the different religions of other peoples that were alive and well in this time, but even within Yahwism, within the religion of Judah, of Jehud, there were many other sanctuaries, local sanctuaries at other places. And when we read, for example, the book of Deuteronomy in the Hebrew Bible, it's as if there was only one sanctuary, namely Jerusalem. So we know that the Hebrew Bible wanted to promote this one specific sanctuary, namely the temple in Jerusalem. But we know, of course, that there were a temple on Mount Gerizim up in the Samaritan area. We know of Elephantine, for example, in Egypt, where there was a Jewish military corps also stationed for quite a long time. So there were also multi-Yahwistic tendencies. It's not that there was only one cult, one temple in Jerusalem. When we speak about the transition to Hellenism, and as I've said that Hellenism had its influence on the highlands where Jerusalem is based, The influence was not so strong or so quickly also showing there. But we know that there was even earlier Greek influence from the very classical Greek traditions. And especially then also we know that there was this famous Greek historian from the 5th century BCE, Herodotus. And some would say that the chronicler also cast his book in a certain sense according to the rules of his history writing from Herodotus. Therefore, things such as genealogies and so on, name lists, and those things play quite a big role. So we shouldn't necessarily only see it in Greek words coming into the book or whatever, but there was already a Greek influence coming from the classical traditions. But then from the time of Alexander the Great, 332 BCE, Alexander started then expanding his empire into the areas of the Levant, where Judah or Jehud was situated. And what we see then at the later stage, then it, the influence came to the highlands, and that Hellenization started becoming sort of the main influence in this area. After the death of Alexander, his kingdom was split into the Ptolemaic kingdom, which was ruled by the Ptolemies, rulers from Egypt, and the Seleucid eras, or the Seleucid rulers, more from the Syrian environment. And these rulers also campaigned against one another to see who would gain the upper hand. In the end, Yehud was firstly ruled by the Ptolemaics, but then later on the Seleucids had some influence, and then things started happening again to the negative, in the sense that the Seleucids put much more pressure on Yehud in terms of their religion and tried to also counter their religion with some Syriac and Greek influences. Now, when we speak about the rhetorical thrust of chronicles within the late Persian period, what is quite confusing is that in the Book of Chronicles, we sometimes see that Jehud is seen as being opposed by some enemy, such as Samaria to the north. But then in some other stories in the same book, we hear that those Samarians were then on the side of the of Yehud. Or we hear that the Persian Empire is normally described in very positive terms, but sometimes there are subtle polemics in the book, which is also sort of making some critical statements in the direction of the empire. Now, what I see behind this is namely that the socio-historical existence in the province of Yehud was definitely not a sort of a one-layered existence. It is rather that there were different levels of existence, starting with the imperial level, which was the overarching level, then the provincial level, for example, with the province to the north, Samaria, Yehud as province, but then also Idumea, as we said, the Philistine, Philistia as province, also along the coast of what is today Lebanon and Syria. So there was some provincial rivalry also. Then on the level of tribal memories, not much to say about that at this stage, but it was between Judah and Benjamin. Those were the two tribal areas of which Yehud consisted. And there was always this thing of remembering Benjamin, but simultaneously also making sure that they never will have a king again, such as Saul, who was evaluated very negatively. On a cultic level, we see there the tensions between those who cultic personnel who were taken away into exile, but then came back after the release by Cyrus II. But in the meantime, some local priesthoods, let's call them jointly sort of the Levites, started moving into the power vacuum in Jerusalem and started directing the cult. So you can just imagine when the people came back from exile, they had these people who never went away, and they started then also quarreling with one another, trying to legitimate the position of the priests again against the Levites. And then the diaspora level, as I've mentioned, that in Elephantinia there was always a Jewish community, but we also know that after the exile or after the release from exile, there were some Jewish communities who opted actually to stay in Babylonia, where they were, even some of them settled in what later on became then the Persian Empire. And you can see even today still in Iran, in the city of Isfahan, there's a Jewish community also there, and a Christian community, by the way. So there were many people, Jewish people in diaspora, which was also, of course, playing a role in the social historical circumstances. So it depends, the rhetorical thrust of Chronicles depends on which level they were talking. When they talked about it to the imperial level, they could not afford showing that they were not really in agreement with one another in Jerusalem, because that could have triggered then the stick, I mean the punishment. So then they had this, everybody loves one another. That's a little bit exaggerated, but Samaria and Jude, they are actually brothers and sisters of one another and so on. But just in the next story, Samaria would be the opponents. Even in one case, Samaria is indicated to be the instrument in the hand of Yahweh, who is punishing Jehud also in the south. So it depends on which level are you talking. That depends on how you are structuring also your rhetorical thrust. Now, all of this is, of course, also related to the issue of identity negotiation. And take note, I'm talking about identity negotiation, which signifies that I'm approaching this also from a constructivist angle and not from an essentialist angle. And it's not that there was simply a construction of an identity. It was an identity negotiation within the context with other peoples, with other groups, and so on. And within such a dynamic process of identity formation, one could distinguish then also between inner group identity negotiation, for example, between the people of Jehud and the people of Samaria, or with the people of Idumea or whatever. But then intergroup would be then to negotiate an identity over against the empire, the Persians. So those two levels of identity negotiation is also, of course, quite clear in the book. From post-colonial theory, one could use the terms hybridity and mimicry also here quite productively, because hybridity means that identities are never sort of, you don't have one identity. You are, say for example, I'm a South African, but I'm also a supporter of the Springbok rugby team. They might, and of course you should know what that means here in France, or are you living in the Nile? I'm not sure. But in any case, there might be some South Africans rather supporting the French rugby team. I saw in South African newspaper last night that there are all kinds of people, trainers and so on, coaches, starting to say, well, France might have a good chance in the next World Cup. So let's see. But in any case, so what I want to say with that, both South Africans, but they support different rugby teams. Now, that's a sort of a very oversimplistic way of explaining something of multiple identities. But that is, of course, what we also see here. It might be that you are from Judah, but you are, in a certain sense, also on the side of the Persians, or you are against them or whatever. And all those groups in Jerusalem had different configurations of identity, one could say. Mimicry is an interesting term from post-colonial theory, which means that you use the tools of the empire to undermine the empire. Now, in Chronicles, there are quite a few subtle things, and let me mention only one. The name Solomon, King Solomon, in the only place in the Hebrew Bible where the name Solomon is etymologized and related to the word shalom, meaning peace, is in Chronicles. Nowhere else in the Bible we get that etymology link. And the reason for that is that the royal theology of the Persians was simply a peace ideology, a Pax Persica or Pax Achaemenidica. Now, they were, of course, not the first who had that kind of thing. Many empires often say that they are actually guarding the peace in the world. I mean, we hear that even today. But we know also that it's a two-sided thing. But within Chronicles, the way in which Solomon is indicated as somebody related to peace, and he's a prince of rest, and the temple in Jerusalem is the house of rest, is clearly also a subtle polemic in the direction of the Persian ideology. So therefore, as I say, that the post-colonial terminology and theory, I think, is quite useful also for describing this kind of societal dynamics. Just before I go to the next one, the map that you see here is actually an indication of the Persian Empire when it was at its biggest extension. And you would know that part and parcel of that is, of course, modern-day Iran. But you see it goes up to the Indus River Valley and in Egypt and what is today Turkey, Anatolia, or Asia Minor. So it was a huge, huge empire which exerted then for around 200 years also their influence. And it was in this time then specifically that the Book of Chronicles was written. Now, when it comes to the issue of redaction in Chronicles, you would remember that last week I concluded my lecture with one example from Thomas Römer's work, where I indicated that Genesis 11, that he has made a distinction between two levels of text, and that the first one he explains then also within the imperial, the Babylonian, the early Persian context. And then the second level was actually also to relate it to Babylon and Babylonia. So there was already in this redaction that took place already a sort of a reinterpretation. So redactional work or redactional criticism is also excellently positioned to help us to the understanding of the ongoing interpretations and reinterpretations that we see in the Bible. Now, we normally make a distinction in chronicle studies between the two German words, the Vorlage, that means which source texts were used, and I've indicated already, especially Samuel Kings, but also other texts from the Pentateuch, and then the so-called Sondergut material, that is the unique material which is not in the Deuteronomistic history or in the other biblical sources that we have available. Now, formerly, chronicle scholars simply kept to that distinction that everything in the Sondergut or of the unique material is then from the chronicler's hand. And that made it very confusing. That is why in my recent commentary that was published recently on Chronicles, I made a distinction then of Sondergut or the unique materials which belongs actually then to the chronicler's hand. And you will see also then I have there chronicler with a P, which means that it has a priestly character, not a Levite character, but a priestly character. And then a second part of the unique material, which could be associated with later redactional fortschreibung or further writing expansion of the basic, the Grundschrift or the basic materials. And that has a Levitic character, and it's particularly in the Passover stories of during the time of King Ezekiel and during King Josiah's reigns, where we see where the Levites become much more prominent and even are indicated to be more holy or more consecrated than the priests. So there's some rivalry between the priesthood and the Levites that we can see also in this. Now, for quite a long period, I would say the past 50 years almost, people were very convinced of the fact that the Book of Chronicles is sort of out of one block. It's a book which consists sort of one book, not much redactional work in it and so on, maybe in the genealogies, but not much more. Now, the direction that I investigated also in my commentary was namely to look at the possibility of approaching the Book of Chronicles also diachronically. That means redaction critically, particularly, to see whether there is also some sort of a reinterpretation that we can witness in the book itself. Now, in that attempt, I started then working with this hypothesis that there were two phases. And take note, I'm not speaking about two levels, I'm speaking about two phases. The first phase is then that the chronicler, who was actually somebody with priestly affiliation, that means those priests who returned from the exile and were based at the Second Temple in Jerusalem, that they, with those priestly affiliations, they created what we could call the Grundschrift or the basic document from the Deuteronomistic history books, Samuel and Kings and other editions and so on from the Pentateuch. But then they also, this writer who compiled the Grundschrift also then made some additions, some modifications, mm-hmm. and that happened more or less in the time period 400 to 350 BCE. But then comes at a later stage, not much later, say about a few decades later, and especially in the time when the Levite priesthood came under much pressure also from particularly the Seleucid rulers, and the fact that there was sort of within the priesthood in Jerusalem a development of a political role for the priests as well. We could speak of a hierocracy or a sort of a theocracy starting to develop within which there was no place for the Levites. And within that phase, it seems then that some later redactions, small redactions were made to the book by somebody with Levite affiliation, and they created then the final book from the Grundschrift plus the modifications of the chronicler, plus then the later editions which all have a Levite character. Now, I can go into all the detailed arguments about how I came to this conclusion, but that will take too much time. But in the basic form of that, this is namely, or basic explanation is to indicate to you that when we look at the Sondergut or the unique material, the priestly character of the book comes from that as well as the Levite character. But it's mostly priestly in the unique materials, and therefore it's more likely that the bigger block of literature would have been the Grundschrift, and that some Levite changes that happened later on was then the second phase. Now, in terms of this perspective on Chronicles, I started working with the term reforming history a few years ago, and that was also the basis of a book that I published in 2016. Now, reforming history, you can see in the English, it's, I don't know, in the French, hopefully as well, yeah, réformer l'histoire, it seems that it's the réformer can be understood as it's reformed, or it is history that is reforming, but it is also history that can reform. Now, you will see in the double meaning of this in English as well, reforming history means that it is the type of literature which is actually contributing to the reformation or the reformulation of the community and their values, but it's also in itself using older traditions and reforming them for that purpose. Now, this quote that I have from Sarah Jaffet was very central also in my own thinking about this issue. Sarah Jaffet described that very potently when she said, the type of literature that we have in Chronicles, she describes this and says, the past was for them increasingly sanctified by later generations, yet at the same time they developed a gap which steadily increased between their own complex reality and the reality they found described in the Bible. Now, I don't agree with her word Bible, because there was no Bible at the stage when the chronicler wrote. One could rather say the older traditions. So they have developed in steadily an increased gap between their own complex reality and the reality they found described in their traditions. A gap of this sort, the inevitable result of historical development, undermines the stability of both realities. First, early history becomes incomprehensible to the present generation, and the norms of a so-called formative period are in fact no longer appropriate to contemporary needs and aspirations. But secondly, present-day institutions, religious tenets, and ritual observance are severed from their origins and lose their authoritative source of legitimation. Now, you can see what she's aiming at with this quote. She's, in a certain sense, trying to say that in the process of history writing, there's both continuity with the past, but also discontinuity with the past. And these are not two processes separately from one another. Separate from one another, they are happening simultaneously. There's some continuation of the older traditions, but simultaneously, there's also some change, adaption, and so on for new circumstances. Now, this is, I think, what Chronicles is doing. But let me use two examples, practical examples that will illustrate this. And of course, it does not have anything to do with Chronicles, but hopefully you will sense the principle that I want to indicate. In the South African school system, what is considered at the moment is to revise the whole history subject for school children, the curriculum that will be taught also in future. And the criticism is, of course, also that it's much too European-centered and it should be more African-centered and so on. But until this year still, the French Revolution is taught as part of the history curriculum in South Africa in schools. That's one of the things that will disappear. So people will live in South Africa not knowing that you had a big revolution here in... now, of course, you can see the pressure of new circumstances, but how do you also hold on to old traditions simultaneously? The other example is that the Notre Dame, we've visited that last week, and my wife sitting here in front was totally disturbed by the fact that the decision was taken in Parliament, I think, that they are going to replace even some of the old windows that were not broken in the fire. They are going to replace that with 20th, 21st century sort of artworks, glass windows. And I've seen also in the comments in the article where this was stated, that some people then reflected also on what should one do when you have an old tradition standing here in the middle of your city, it burns down, how should you rebuild it? And should you then put the 21st century into it, or should you try to reconstruct the older contexts? Now, as far as I know, the Notre Dame has burned down a few times, so it's also not the original thing that we have here, but you might know better. But hopefully you understand in these two examples, it's sort of the pressure, there's a need for adaption also to new circumstances, new contexts, and so on. But on the other hand, how do you hold fast also to the traditions of the past? Now, that is exactly what Chronicles is all about. It's in a certain sense negotiating between the past and the present within which they were writing. And you remember that I spoke about the Persian period within which they were writing this book. Now, I'm going to illustrate this also from the book of Chronicles. And very quickly, the King Manasseh of Judah is portrayed in the Hebrew Bible in two totally different ways. In the Deuteronomistic version, in 2 Kings 21, verse 1 to 18, we see a King Manasseh, which is the epitome of royal failure. He is even blamed for the fact that the people were taken into exile. He was the worst of all the kings, according to the Deuteronomistic history. The Chronicler's version in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 1 to 20, indicates that King Manasseh was a repentant king, and he was an example of what it means to rely on Yahweh. Thank you very much for reminding me about this. So the Chronicler's version is emphasizing that Manasseh is a repentant king and is an example of what it means to rely on Yahweh. And I'm going to illustrate this now by reading you simply the two texts so that you can also follow them. Let's start in the left-hand column and you can follow in the French there. I'm reading it in the English. 2 Kings 21 from verse 9. And take note, this is a section now, what I'm going to read from Kings is a section that was totally taken out of the text by the chronicler. The chronicler cut that totally out of the literature. So the text in 2 Chronicles 21, or 2 Kings 21. But they did not listen, and Manasseh led them astray to do more evil than the nations had done, whom the Lord destroyed before the people of Israel. And the Lord said by his servants the prophets, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations and has done things more evil than all that the Amorites did, who were before him, and has made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing upon Jerusalem and Judah such disaster that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. And it continues again in the left-hand column. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plumb line of the house of Ahab. And I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. And I will forsake the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. And they shall become a prey and a spoil to all their enemies. Because they have done what is evil in my sight, and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt, even to this day. Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood, till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another, besides the sin that he made Judah to sin, that they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So that's the king's version. Let's go back and read now the chronicler's version in the right-hand column from verse 11 of 2 Chronicles 33. Therefore the Lord brought upon them the commanders of the army of the king of Assyria, who captured Manasseh with hooks. And take note, this is not in Samuel or in the book of Kings, it's only in Chronicles. So he captured Manasseh with hooks and bound him with chains of bronze and brought him to Babylon. And when he was in distress, he entreated the favor of the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. He prayed to him, and God was moved by his entreaty and heard his plea and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. And the text continues. Afterward, he built an outer wall for the city of David west of Gion in the valley and for the entrance into the fish gate and carried it around Ophel and raised it to a very great height. He also put commanders of the army in all the fortified cities in Judah. And he took away the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord and all the altars that he had built on the mountain of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem. And he threw them outside of the city. He also restored the altar of the Lord and offered on it a sacrifice of peace offerings and of thanksgiving. And he commanded Judah to serve the Lord, the God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. Now, do you see, it's a totally different Manasseh being described in Chronicles. Now, people have started arguing with one another long ago already to ask, why is it that the chronicler presented such a different picture? Now, one of the reasons mentioned is namely that we know from history that King Manasseh was the king who ruled the longest in the history of Judah. He was a king for 55 years. It's almost as long as the queen of Queen Elizabeth of the UK ruled, but not yet, not exactly. But 55 years he was king, and the argument is then that they in Chronicles wanted to correct the historical picture, because how can it be that somebody who ruled 55 years was a bad king? He must have been a good king. So that's the logic sort of behind that explanation. And there might be something about that also behind it. But my hypothesis about this text is rather that it wants to explain in Chronicles what it means to turn around from being the utmost of sinner against the Lord to somebody who is repentant and who is then also restored in the kingship and who is relying on Yahweh. Now, the word rely, you have seen a few times here, and you will see that later in another example that I bring to you. But it's very clear that the chronicler's version was not focusing on the exile, because the exile was already past them. He was focusing on the present in the Persian period. And he wanted to indicate also what is the right conduct for leaders of the people, and what is the right conduct even which is expected from the Persian king. So this is actually what is expected, namely that somebody who turned around, repented, and relied on Yahweh is then the one who serves Yahweh and who is building the city and the temple and purging the land also of all the idols. So a totally different Manasseh, but totally understandable. The one thing, unfortunately, that we don't get in Chronicles is namely the words of the prayer. But we know from other manuscripts, Qumran manuscripts and later traditions, even into the early Christian tradition, we know of prayers of Manasseh. In the Catholic Bible, there's even at the end of the book of Daniel, if I remember correctly, the book of Psalms. That's the best one, third time lucky. So at the book, there's an extra psalm among others also in the Septuagint version and therefore also in the Catholic canon where this prayer of Manasseh is given. Now, of course, that text comes from a much later period and the need was maybe there also to fill in this piece of lacking information in Chronicles with this. Okay, so let me then come to the reception of Chronicles in post-apartheid South Africa. How does Chronicles feature within the post-apartheid situation? Now, very shortly, and I'm not going to dwell on that, is that we see some very literal and ideological interpretations of Chronicles. One example, there was a rich businessman in the early 2000s who read 2 Chronicles 7 verse 14, which says, "If my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." Now that "my people" is then interpreted by this person as the South African nation. And then the South African nation should repent, they should humble themselves and seek the face of the Lord, who will then bring them back from their wicked ways, which is of course referring to criminality, to corruption and whatever in South Africa. Now this is of course not the kind of hermeneutic that Chronicles is actually giving us. Chronicles as a hermeneutical guide is rather helping us to understand how the reforming of history should also take place in our own days. And I'm going to just mention this one example. I don't have the time to go into details, but a colleague of mine who was also my doctoral student, Ntozake Zula, did his doctorate on the issue of a theology of liberation moving over to a theology of reconstruction. Because after the fall of apartheid, then people also within the black community started saying, we should not think about the theology of liberation any longer because we've been liberated, but we should rather also start thinking about the theology of reconstruction. And it was interesting that the text that they used for that then was, as a biblical paradigm, was the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ntozake Kazula then indicated in his dissertation that that's definitely not the right book to use because it is actually excluding many members from in society. It's much more an exclusivist ideology that we get in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. And he suggested then that Chronicles is a much better paradigm for a theology of reconstruction. And especially then the inclusivist tone that we see also in the book of Chronicles. Now, I don't have enough time then to explain all of this, but I'm happy to ask my colleague to send you his articles, and even his dissertation is available on the internet if anyone would have an interest to read it. And let me come to my conclusion. Somebody, and I don't know who, said, "The Bible is a bunch of texts in restless conversation with one another." The Bible is a bunch of texts in restless conversation with one another. We've heard that in the origin of the Hebrew Bible, that there are many different texts over the ages that came into the picture. We have a long period through which this happened, and we know that younger texts were in conversation also with older texts. And that there was a to and fro also between different biblical constellations or biblical literature. And this is then what we could call the dialogic mode of inner biblical interpretation. So it's not only we who have to do interpretation in a dialogic mode, it's rather that within the processes of inner biblical interpretation, we already see this dialogic mode, that it's a to and fro, it's a conversation which in the end leads then also to further insights. Now, the point that is emphasized here is namely that the contextuality of the ancient text's origins are very important. We can't skip the history behind the text. We can't forget about the world behind the text. Because otherwise, if we jump too quickly from the text itself to our own context, then we can do anything with the texts. But if we take Chronicles as an example, and many other biblical examples can be indicated, if we go through the historical contexts to see what the rhetorical thrust was in the historical context, then we would be in a better position also to contextualize that for modern-day contexts of interpretation. So interpretation does not happen only within the circumstances of our own time. It's also within the circumstances of the text's origin. Remember the continuity, discontinuity thing that I mentioned earlier. So if I can come back to the question that I asked right at the beginning of last week's lecture, can or may biblical interpretation change? Then we can even say it is necessary that it should change. Because the dynamic renewal of tradition only happens through the continuous reinterpretation in new socio-historical circumstances. There's a scholar, Bernie Levinson, who has done research on the legal collections that we have in the Pentateuch, And the point that he is making is namely to say that change is in a certain sense the dynamo that keeps the tradition alive. Continuity, discontinuity. If you simply cling to the past, the tradition is going to die out. If you simply cling to the present, then you don't have any grounding for what you are actually having as your traditions. So what is in the end also, I think, suggested by Chronicles is namely to be grounded within the past, but simultaneously being able to also change within new socio-historical circumstances. And this brings us then back to what I've mentioned also last week, Gadamer's very famous adage saying, meaning arises through a fusion of horizons. Chronicles is in a certain sense showing us also how important it is to take both horizons, the historical horizon and the horizon of our own contexts into consideration. Because then if there's a fusion of horizons between the text and the interpreter within the tradition, then I think it can lead also to more adequate and more responsible biblical interpretation. So that's my story for today. I thank you for your attention, and then there's time for questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.